Francis Scott Key. He was born August 1st, 1779. Died January 11th, 1843. Francis Scott Key was a respected young lawyer living in Georgetown, just west of where the modern-day Key Bridge crosses the Potomac River. The house is no longer there. It was torn down in 1947. He made his home there from 1804 to around 1833 with his wife Mary and their six sons and five daughters. At the time, Georgetown was a thriving town of 5,000 people just a few miles from the Capitol, the White House, and the federal buildings of Washington. But after war broke out in 1812 over Britain's attempts to regulate American shipping and other activities while Britain was at war with France, all was not tranquil in Georgetown. The British had entered Chesapeake Bay on August 19, 1814, and by the evening of the 24th of August, the British had invaded and captured Washington. They set fire to the Capitol and the White House, and flames were visible 40 miles away in Baltimore. President James Madison, his wife Dolly, and his cabinet had already fled to a safer location, such in their haste to leave that they had to rip the Stuart portrait of George Washington from the walls without its frame. A thunderstorm at dawn kept the fires from spreading. The next day, more buildings were burned, and again a thunderstorm dampened the fires. Having done their work, the British troops returned to their ships in and around the Chesapeake Bay. In the days following the attack on Washington, the American forces prepared for an assault on Baltimore, back then a population of 40,000, and they knew would come by both land and sea. Word soon reached Francis Scott Key that the British had carried off an elderly and much-loved town physician of Upper Marlboro, Dr. William Beans, and was being held on the British flagship Teutonic. The town folk feared that Dr. Beans would be hanged, and they asked Francis Scott Key for his help, and he agreed, and arranged to have Colonel John Skinner, an American agent for prisoner exchange, to accompany him. On the morning of September 3rd, he and Colonel Skinner set sail from Baltimore aboard a sloop flying a flag of truce approved by President Madison. On the 7th, they found and boarded the Teutonic to confer with General Ross and Admiral Alexander Cochrane. At first, they refused to release Dr. Beans, but Key and Skinner produced a pouch of letters written by wounded British prisoners praising the care they were receiving from the Americans, among them Dr. Beans. The British officers relented, but would not release three Americans immediately because they had seen and heard too much of the preparations for the attack on Baltimore. They were placed under guard, first aboard the HMS Surprise, then into the sloop, and forced to wait out the battle behind the British fleet. Now we'll go back to the summer of 1813 for a moment. At the star-shaped Fort McHenry, the commander, Major George Armistead, asked for a flag to be so big that the British would have no trouble seeing it in the distance. He knew that his fort was going to be attacked, and he wanted to make sure they knew where to find it. So two officers, a commodore and a general, were sent to the Baltimore home of Mary Young Pinkersgill, a maker of colors, and commissioned the flag. Mary and her 13-year-old daughter, Caroline, worked in the upstairs front bedroom using 400 yards of the best quality wool bunting. They cut 15 stars that measured 2 feet from point to point. 8 red and 7 white stripes, each 2 feet wide, were cut. Laying out the material on the malt house floor at Claggart's Brewery, a neighborhood establishment, the flag was sewn together. By August, it was finished, and it measured 30 by 42 feet. It cost a whopping $405.90. Probably very expensive back then. The Baltimore Flag House and Museum now occupies their premises, which were restored in 1953. Well, back to September 13th. It was 7 a.m. in the morning of September 13th, 1814. The British bombardment began, and the flag was ready to meet the enemy. The bombardment continued for 25 hours. The British firing 1,500 bombshells that weighed as much as 220 pounds. True, today that's like a firecracker. But back then, that was probably pretty scary. And carried lighted fuses that would supposedly cause it to explode when it reached its target. But they said it wasn't very dependable and often blew up in midair. From special small boats, the British fired a new Congreve rockets that traced wobbly arcs of red flame across the sky. But the Americans had sunk 22 of these vessels, so they really couldn't get very close when they were firing them, so they weren't even hitting their target. But at about 1 a.m. on the 14th, the British fleet, they stopped for a while, and then at 1 a.m. on the 14th, the British fleet roared to life again, sending in more bombs. Key, Colonel Skinner, and Dr. Beans watched the battle with apprehension. They knew that as long as the shelling continued, Fort McHenry had not surrendered. But long before daylight, there came a sudden stop. Mysterious stop to the bombing. What the three Americans did not know was that the British land assault on Baltimore, as well as the naval attack, had been abandoned, judging Baltimore to be too costly a prize. The British officers ordered a retreat. Waiting in the pre-dawn darkness, Key waited for the sight that would end his anxiety. He was hoping to see the general's great flag. And when that last daylight came, the flag was there. Being an amateur poet and being so uniquely inspired, Key began to write on the back of a letter he had in his pocket. Sailing back to Baltimore, he composed more lines and in his lodgings at the Indian Queen Hotel. He'd finished the poem. When he had finished it, Judge J.H. Nicholson, his brother-in-law, took it to the printer, and copies were circulated around Baltimore under the title Defense of Fort McHenry. Two of these copies survive. I'd like to have one of those copies. It was printed in the newspaper for the first time in Baltimore Patriot on September 20th, 1814. Then in papers as far away as Georgia and New Hampshire. In October, a Baltimore actor sang Key's new song in a public performance and called it the Star-Spangled Banner. Immediately popular, it remained just one of several patriotic airs until it was finally adopted as our national anthem on March 3, 1931. But the actual words were not included in the legal documents. King himself wrote several versions with slight variations, so discrepancies in the exact wording still occur. The flag, our beloved Star-Spangled Banner, went on view for the first time after flying over Fort McHenry on January 1, 1876 at the old State House in Philadelphia for the nation's centennial celebration. It now resides in the Smithsonian's Institution, a museum of American history. Francis Scott Key was a witness to the last enemy fire to fall on Fort McHenry. Francis Scott Key was a deeply religious man, but he said he could see God's hands in how the battle turned out. I mean, there's just no way we should have been able to hold off that kind of attack. And if you go back about the White House and all the other government buildings that were set on fire, as soon as they were on fire, thunderstorms developed and put the fire out. And when they done it again, more thunderstorms. So you can see God's hand in that. So do we see God's hand in our lives, in our country, or around the world, even today? We have plenty of examples in the Bible. Let's look at Daniel in the lion's den. Was it Daniel who bound the lion's mouths? King Darius could see God's hand, was in it when he said, I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble in fear, for the the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So it wasn't hard for him to see that God was the one that saved Daniel. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not cause the fire not to consume them. How did Nebuchadnezzar respond when he saw that they were not touched? He was astonished that he saw a fourth person in the middle of the fire, and that all four of them were walking around unharmed. The fourth one stood out because he made the comment they had the appearance of the Son of God. When the men came out of the fire, they did not even have the smell of fire on them. And then he said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies. And they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made of ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this." Well, I'd like to turn to a couple of examples here. If we would turn to Exodus 14 and verse 13. Exodus 14, verse 13. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians, whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever." This is at the crossing of the sea when God rolled the waters to each side and caused the wind to dry it out and allow them to cross. And even in verse 14, the Lord will fight for you and you shall hold your peace, which basically means just keep quiet, quit complaining. But it just showed that God was there for him. And it was God's hand who took care of him. If you'll turn to Judges 7, verses 2 through 15. Judges 7, 2 through 15. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give to the Midianites, to their hands, lest Israel claim victory for itself against me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.' Now therefore proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead.' And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, 'These people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Then it will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same shall go with you. And of whomever I say to you, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go.' So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, 'Everyone who laps from the water with their tongues as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink. And the number of those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water.'" So he went from 30,000 men to 300. And being in the military, you really want to be that opposite. Go from 300 to 32,000. "Then the Lord said to Gideon, 'By the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place.' So the people took provisions and their trumpets in their hands and sent away all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained those 300 men. Now the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. It happened on the same night that the Lord said to him, "Arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hands. But if you are afraid to go down, go down to the camp with Purah, your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands will be strengthened to go down against the camp." Then he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. Now the Midianites and Amalekites, all the people of the east, were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as they stand by the seashore in multitude. I mean, it is innumerable. You couldn't count how many was there. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to a companion. He said, "I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. It came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed." Then his companion answered and said, "This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand God has delivered Midian and his whole camp." And so it was, when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation, that he worshipped. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp to Midian into your hand." This shows God's hand. Gideon had tens of thousands of men, and God dwindled it down to 300. There's a story out of World War II, and I can't remember if I heard it maybe in a sermon one time or read it, where the Americans were down just a few men, no fuel, and they were just waiting it out. Germans, they were heavily armed, they had plenty of fuel. So they settled in and waited until morning, and were astonished when the Germans came out and surrendered without a fight. And they'd asked the Germans why they'd surrendered. And they said, well, they'd heard the driving back and forth, and the equipment moving, and men moving, and they just knew that they were outmanned, had too much equipment on the American side, so that's why they surrendered. But the Americans didn't make a sound. They didn't waste any fuel. They didn't have any fuel to waste. So again, it's one of God intervening. Turn to last scripture, to Job 41. 11. Job 41, verse 11. "Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine." So, yes, even though Satan is the god of this world, God owns it all. And we should not be surprised that God intervenes. His arm is not too short to still reach down and help us in our times of need.